to wait. So getting through the regulators in a timely manner is crucially important. So we have, to your question, we have completed all of our studies. We've completed all of the global trials. We have presented an enormous dossier of information and data to the MHRA, the UK regulator. And I'd like to stress too that being UK-based, we took that decision to go to the UK regulator first.
So Sonia, we're almost out of time. Just give me roughly a time frame when you hope this will be available.
It is in their power to be assessing this right now towards the end of the month. So we would hope to hear fairly shortly after that, give a direction of whether what their intention is with delivering this drug to the people who so crucially need it.
All right. Well, Dr. Sonia Miller, many thanks for joining us on The Times at One. The clock ticks on. That's pretty much it from me. Of course, stay with Times Radio for all the developments at the White House over the next few hours. I'm delighted to say Jane has just walked into the studio and she appears to be flying solo today, Jane.
Oh, she's still not back. She is back. Fee's back tomorrow. She's allowed a holiday, isn't she? I guess. Seems wrong to me, but anyway.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Good afternoon to you. It is 2 o'clock. This is Jane Garvey on Times Radio until four. And on the programme today, well, all eyes on Washington, D.C. again, as world leaders, including President Zelensky and our Prime Minister Keir Starmer, meet in the White House to discuss the war in Ukraine. We'll look ahead to what, if anything, might be decided today. Now, forget tech startups. Is war, actually, the best thing to invest in 2025? That's a cheerful prospect. We'll be talking to a venture capitalist. We'll also ask why £200 billion worth of government projects could be at risk of failure. And our big guest is someone who actually knows all about choreographing big events at the White House. It's the former social secretary under the Obamas, a woman called Disha Dyer. She's fascinating. You can hear from her after 3:30. Let's start with the latest news. Here's James Kitchen.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. Volodymyr Zelensky has accused Moscow of carrying out demonstrative and cynical strikes ahead of talks with Donald Trump at the White House. 10 people have been killed in the Ukrainian cities of Zaporizhia and Kharkiv, with the youngest being a one-year-old girl. The US president claims his Ukrainian counterpart could end the war almost immediately, but won't offer him NATO membership or the return of Crimea as part of any deal. Gideon Rachman is chief foreign affairs commentator of the Financial Times and author of The Age of the Strongman. He told Times Radio President Trump has visions of himself as the ultimate peacemaker.
Tension is almost an end in itself for Trump, but also he does have this vision of himself as a great peacemaker, and he's almost childishly open about his desire to win the Nobel Peace Prize and so on. So I think in his mind, he wants to be the guy who brings Zelensky and Putin together to shake hands and, you know, have a warm embrace and settle it, and then afterwards both say, this could never have happened without Donald Trump. I don't think any of that is going to happen, but I think, yeah, that would be his ultimate vision of how this should end.
Meanwhile, Sir Keir Starmer, who's flying to Washington with other European leaders, says Britain's prepared to put boots on the ground in Ukraine to act as a security guarantee in the event of a deal. Michael O'Hanlon is an American policy analyst from the Brookings Institution. He told Times Radio there's ambiguity to what such a guarantee would look like.
There are different ways to think about this. Some people have talked about Article 5-like provisions that are not done through NATO, but that requires Senate confirmation in our system, two-thirds vote. And I don't think we're anywhere near forming a treaty that would do that. You could also more pragmatically just have a lot of NATO troops on the ground in Ukraine doing various kinds of training and observation. And that could essentially become a tripwire, a de facto security guarantee.
Elsewhere, senior politicians in Northern Ireland, Scotland and Wales are urging the Prime Minister to recall Parliament over the conflict in Gaza. They've written a letter to Sir Keir Starmer calling for immediate sanctions on Israel. Stormont's First Minister Michelle O'Neill and the Westminster leaders of the SNP and Plaid Cymru are among the signatories. The British government says it will recognise a Palestinian state in September if there's no ceasefire. A man's been found guilty for his role in a shooting in East London that left a 9-year-old girl with a bullet lodged in her brain. Javon Riley's been convicted of 3 counts of attempted murder following the incident in Dalston in May last year. A court's heard a shot missed his intended target and hit the girl, who was sitting outside a restaurant. Detective Inspector Ben Dalloway from the Met Police says she'll forever be affected.
It was only through the fantastic work of the surgeons at the Great Ormond Street Hospital that she survived. The bullet remains lodged in her brain and forever will be. She has made a good recovery. However, she'll have cognitive and difficulties for the rest of her life.
And it's been revealed the bosses of Britain's biggest firms are making record amounts of pay. Median salaries for chief executives at FTSE 100 companies have reached £4.8 million. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Good afternoon to you. Hope you're well. Hope you had a decent weekend. It's Jane Garvey here on Times Radio until 4 o'clock. Fee is back from our holidays tomorrow. Very much looking forward to that. You can contact the programme on the WhatsApp number 0333 003 2353. Busy old day, but then we haven't had a quiet day for a while, have we? Today, all eyes on the White House as Trump hosts Zelensky, Starmer, Maloney, Macron and Mertz. And here is Sakir speaking on the plane on his way over.
This war in Ukraine has been going on a really long time now, I mean, 3+ years. Hugely impacted the Ukrainians who've suffered hugely, but it's also impacted Europe, it's impacted every single family and community in the United Kingdom. And so everybody wants it to end, not least the Ukrainians. But we've got to get this right. We've got to make sure there is peace, that it is lasting peace. And that it is fair and that it is just. And that's why I'm travelling to Washington with other European leaders to discuss this face-to-face with President Trump and President Zelensky, because it's in everyone's interests, it's in the UK's interests, that we get this right.
Well, that's the Prime Minister on the plane on his way over to the States speaking just a little bit earlier. Let me just give you some of the timings for today, because you'll probably want to keep up with this. It's not until 5 o'clock our time that the European leaders are due to arrive at the White House. And then it won't be until 7:30 p.m. our time that the President gets them together for a so-called family photo. And then at 8 o'clock our time, the President will take part in a multilateral meeting with the European leaders. And all of that you can keep up with here on Times Radio in the company of John Pienaar and Kate Borsay as the evening proceeds. So you won't miss a trick if you stick with Times Radio. They'll keep you fully up to date, John and Kate. But we will anticipate what might be decided at the White House a little later in this programme today. I've got an interesting big guest, and it's not unrelated, because the big guest after 3:30 today is Disha Dyer. Now, she used to be the social secretary at the White House under the Obamas. You might well ask, well, what does the social secretary do? Do you know what? That's the first question I'm going to ask her. Might be the second, but it'll certainly be one of the first questions I ask her, because she isn't a political appointment, but she choreographs. I don't think it's always a woman. The person in that role choreographs events at the White House of one sort or another. And Disha comes from the kind of background that you wouldn't necessarily expect. She didn't go to Harvard or Princeton. She went to a community college and started as a White House intern back in 2009 when she was already in her 30s. So she's got quite the story to tell. And she probably doesn't like Donald Trump all that much. But I'll ask her about that as well. You never know. She might have some sort of grudging respect for him. Anything's possible. So Disha Dyer, the author of a book about her time as the White House Social Secretary. That book is called Undiplomatic, and she'll be with me after 3:30. Later in the programme today as well, there's Money in War, but who makes it and how? Why too many tourists in Italy are attempting the absolutely ridiculous. They're going hiking in flip-flops. And frankly, the authorities there have had enough. We'll talk to the royal editor of the Sunday Times, Roy Otnika, about William and Kate's plans to downsize to an 8-bedroomed house. It's called Forest Lodge. Where is it? What is it? Is 8 bedrooms really downsizing? We'll ask Roya about that later. And it's Monday, so it's Literary Salon Day here on Times Radio Afternoons. Laura Hackett will discuss a new American novel with an unnamed protagonist. We'll talk about a feminist classic about life in the Fens and an Anne Enright book that you should most definitely read on Laura's recommendation. That's all later. Plus, Money Matters with Holly Mead, host of the Times Feel Better About Money podcast. Today, should you bother forking out for a financial advisor? And how do you know, in fact, when you've got a half-decent one? That's later in Times Radio's afternoon programme this Monday. A quick look at the most read stories on the Times website today. At number three, Mike Lynch's widow felt safe on yacht minutes before it sank. This is the widow of the British IT tycoon Mike Lynch, who's told investigators she had total faith in his super yacht. At number two, Ukraine, Russia latest, UK ready to deploy troops for security, says Starmer. Much more on that throughout the day here on Times Radio, of course. And the most read piece, the one I've just mentioned, Kate is downsizing and living life on her own terms now. That's on the news that the Prince and Princess of Wales are moving to a so-called smaller property. I'll be talking to Roy Arnica of the Sunday Times a little later. You know, you can read all of these articles on thetimes.com. You will need a digital subscription. And if you don't have one, you can get one by going to thetimes.com/subscribe. If you are a digital subscriber to The Times and The Sunday Times, you do have access to a whole range of newsletters, including the politics newsletter. Now, it comes straight to your inbox every weekday morning. And to sign up, just log into your Times account and head to the My Newsletters section. Now, a sum of money equal to the entire NHS budget, that's almost £200 billion, is tied up in government projects at risk of failing. This is according to The Times, which reports on the huge cost of programmes given a red rating by the government's auditors. Now, this means they're not only a financial risk, but they are unachievable in their current form. And they're far from the only projects going a bit belly up. Remember, HS2 curtailed due to the overrunning costs. So why can't we get things done? Why can't we get these things right? Why do things keep going wrong? Now, Lord Barclay is a Labour peer. He's a civil engineer, and he's written a number of reports over the years on the HS2 rail programme. Lord Barclay, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon.
Now, I think it's fair to say you were never keen on HS2, really, were you?
Well, not really, but mainly because I thought it was the wrong project, and of course, the costs were going through the roof. So it was a very good one, a good example of why not to do something.
Okay. Yes. I mean, we don't want to be too unambitious, though, do we? I mean, let's just talk briefly about this National Infrastructure and Service Transformation Authority, or NISTA. Now, I have to say, I can't pretend I'm not over familiar with this body. This report is worth hearing, though, is it?
Well, the report is worth hearing, but it's a follow-on report from a previous organisation that also produced traffic lights, red, green and yellow. And the problem with the last one was that nobody took a blind bit of notice of it in government. And I fear that the present one will suffer the same way, because unless somebody is held to account and loses their job and doesn't get a knighthood at the end of it, this is just going to go on and on.
Okay, let's talk about this red rating idea then. You've mentioned the so-called traffic light system. If a project is red rated, does it mean it's likely to fail, or is it going to cost the taxpayer a heap of money, or is it both?
It's probably both, but the reason it's so important is it's likely to fail. Maybe because the costs are going through the roof. Maybe because it's the wrong project to do whatever they want to do. And it's very easy for ministers and members of Parliament in the House of Lords as well to say, we'd love to have this project, whatever it be. We'd love to have it, whatever the cost. Because, of course, they're not paying for it. But somehow we've got to get round this and say, you don't do it unless you have a firm budget, and if you're going to overturn the budget, then you've got to stop. You should resign and think again.
Why is it then that we just seem so bad, or certain people in this country seem so bad at doing exactly that?
Well, I don't know, but we've talked about HS2, but there's Hinkley Point, nuclear, which is in a similar situation. There's the ferries in Scotland, which maybe doesn't come out of the UK budget, but they're still a disaster for the people of Scotland. And I think it's partly to the fact that nobody is held responsible. And the permanent secretaries in these departments, if it's a spending one, they should be told, you don't spend any more money unless you've got the authority and to finish the job. Because each department has something called an accounting officer who's financially responsible for all the expenditure in that department. But this hasn't happened on HS2. The civil servants have batted on. They've even given ministers bum information, if I can call it that, so that ministers can give the right answers to parliamentarians, and so the project still goes ahead, which is what happened on HS2. But I suspect it's true the world over in this country. Somebody needs to be held responsible, and if it goes wrong, they lose their jobs, their pensions, and they start again.
So it's interesting. You appear, and do correct me if I'm wrong, to be pointing the finger firmly at the civil service and not at the politicians.
I'm pointing my finger at both, because on the HS2 example I quote, it was Nusgarny MP and Chris Grayling MP who were fed bum information by the civil servants, and they therefore told Parliament, a porky, basically, that the project was on budget and on time when it was 10 billion over. You know,
In fairness to them, they're not here to defend themselves, we should say, but that's clearly your take. I mean, I think most of us are familiar with HS2 and Hinkley Point as well, but I must confess, I did not know about the government's plans for an underground geological disposal facility for our nuclear waste. This is due to be constructed, we're told, up to 1,000 metres below ground, but no site has yet been identified. Auditors say the cost could come in at anywhere between 20.3 and 53.3 billion pounds. Are you concerned about this?
Well, I'm very concerned. I mean, I've over the years, the nuclear waste windscale, or whatever it's called, has been a problem. It's upset the Irish government on many occasions. But until we know how this is going to work, whether it will work, as the scientists say it will, at a cost which we can afford, we should not be diving into it. And the trouble is, ministers think it's a great thing to do. Let's dive into this. It'll look good in paper and look good on the ballot sheet, but it's not going to work. And if there's going to be a serious overrun, or there's something which means that the thing will not work in the future.
Thank you very much indeed for your time. That is Lord Barclay. And let's just get to you on this one. Jane, I worked in NHS commissioning. Time after time, I've seen poor commissioning and contract management being outwitted by the private sector. The government are notoriously bad at contract management. Rob says they lose their pensions. Grow up. How are you going to convince anyone to work for the civil service if idiots like this man want to take their pensions? Well, I mean, Lord Barclay is certainly not an idiot. He's a man with a view and years of experience as a civil engineer himself. But thank you, Rob. I appreciate it. 0333 003 2353. Do let us know what you think about anything at all we're discussing on the programme this afternoon. Busy day and lots of anticipation about what's going to unfold at the White House a little bit later. Next on this programme, why are tourists in flip-flops causing a stir in the Dolomites? This is Times Radio. It is 17 minutes past two.
Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6 on Times Radio.
Hi, it's Rosie sitting in for Kate this week on Breakfast with Stig. The eyes of the world are on the White House. We'll discuss whatever is decided.
The former Justice Secretary Alex Chalk and the Times' Manveen Rana will talk about that and the day's other news. And we'll ask, what is the point of zoos and should they prosper by feeding one set of animals to another set of animals?
Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6 on Times Radio.
Ah, claim approved. Direct Line's ready to send my new laptop within 2 hours. That's how it's done. Imagine if that's how everything got done. Like teaching little Johnny to play his recorder.
Oh, my.
That's my boy!
Direct Line. That's how it's done.
Theft and accidental loss claims up to £3,000. Cover limits apply. Personal possessions cover needed for items outside the home.
As a small business owner, you've got to be ready for the ups and the downs. Ready to think on your feet, ready to be rushed off your feet, ready to make the big decisions and make the tea. Two sugars in mind? Ta. Ready to be there for your customers whenever they need you. Well, ditto. Virgin Media Broadband's ready for anything business can throw at it. Yeah, it's business ready broadband. Search Virgin Media Business Broadband.
Listen at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
This is Times Radio.
Hikers in flip-flops in a moment. First to a bit of sport, and the Premier League is back. Liverpool started off on Friday with a late win, 2 goals in the last couple of minutes at Anfield against Bournemouth on Friday night. Arsenal managed a big away win over Manchester United yesterday. And TalkSport presenter Charlotte Richardson joins me now. Hello, Charlotte. How are you?
Good afternoon, Jane. I'm really well, thank you. Yeah,
now, because of a technical issue here at Times Towers, I'm able to see lots of WhatsApp messages actually meant for TalkSport and Virgin Radio. So I'm having a very entertaining afternoon. I'm also getting my own messages, but I'm getting everybody else's too. And Tony says, "Hi lads, Liverpool will win the Premier League title. Suck it up," says Tony. I mean, Tony could be right, actually, Charlotte. What do you think?
I think Tony has got a very good point. Liverpool kick-started a weekend of Premier League action, and it's so good to see the return of the Premier League because it does provide all the drama, the levels of never really knowing which team will turn up. Any team can beat any team, and we saw that. And I think Liverpool, with the way that they've spent and recruited over what has, of course, been such a difficult summer with the death of Diogo Jota, that emotional tie, and with all of that coming together at the cauldron that is Anfield to get the job done and win 4-2 certainly set the tone. But of course, they are the team to beat. I think lots is expected of Arsenal. Chelsea being the World Club champions, how could they bring that form and that high from the summer into the Premier League? And that's all I want from this season, Jane. I really want a title race that goes right down to the wire and is as competitive as possible.
Okay, oh, that would be good, wouldn't it? And actually, Arsenal, how many times have they finished second, actually? I can't remember.
Three in a row, hat-trick. A very much unwanted hat-trick at that, finishing second.
Yeah, it's a bit grim for their fans. I guess they do want a bit of progress there. There has been some development in the nasty incident at Anfield, actually, on Friday, that racist abuse of the Bournemouth striker, who then went on to score 2 goals.
Yeah, and credit to Anton Semenyo for doing that, because the mentality it takes to go on and carry on and score when you have been the victim of racial abuse is quite incredible, really. Updates since that point, a man has been arrested on suspicion of racially abusing Bournemouth's centre forward, and he has today been banned from every football stadium in the UK. A 47-year-old man arrested on Saturday on suspicion of a racially aggravated public order defence, and he has been conditionally bailed. And today, that stadium ban has been put in place.
Okay, and much more happily, for people who are just general football fans, it's great to have Sunderland back in the Premier League, and they won at the weekend.
Yeah, it is so good to have Sunderland back in the Premier League. And wow, how they marched their return with a 3-0 win over West Ham, an absolutely packed stadium of light. It's their first appearance back in the top flight since the 2016-17 season, and they scored 3 goals in 30 second half minutes, which totally blew West Ham United away. And the thing I really liked about their victory, Jane, was that each of the goal scorers was part of their promotion from the Championship. And lots gets said at this time of year about who's going to win the title, who's going to get relegated, and lots of pundits, lots of reporters saying that they could see a repeat of what happened last season, as in the top three from the Championship getting relegated straight back down. But Sunderland have been really shrewd in their recruitment. They have spent lots of money. But what Saturday's results showed as well is that they have a really good squad who have, although it's only 90 minutes, there's a long way to go, have stepped up. And the thing that's really powerful in football, and you can have all the money in the world, but if you don't have the synergy between the squad that's playing on the field of play and the supporters around the ground, I don't think you're going to get what you want out of a season. And from what I saw on Saturday, Sunderland have that character in abundance and they have some talent that's going to cause a few teams some problems. And for West Ham to be on the end of that result, pressure mounting already on Graham Potter, which sounds ridiculous to say.
Crazy, yeah, but already people are saying, oh, we'll be a goner.
Yep.
Not too far from Sunderland, their arch enemies, Newcastle. Now, they've got a striker who really doesn't want to be there. And actually, I think he wants to go to Liverpool. And those two teams are playing each other, aren't they, very soon?
Yes, yes. I mean, it's just the way it goes, isn't it? The rumour wheel has been buzzing around Alexander Isak throughout the summer. And I know a lot of Newcastle fans are furious in the way that, as a professional, Isak has refuse to play, not be involved with the first team squad. And it's just not what a team wants going into the start of a campaign. And I think the way that Eddie Howe has dealt with all of that noise around Isak has been really credible. But when they turned up to Villa Park and they drew 0-0, I think lots of people thinking, oh my goodness, if Isak was leading that line, if those chances were falling to a player like Isak, Newcastle would have got all 3 points. It hasn't seemed like much has manoeuvred since Liverpool had their first bid for Isak rejected. But I think for those involved with Newcastle United Football Club, especially Eddie Howe, he wants a solution, some sort of resolution as soon as possible. But I do not expect Alexander Isak to play in that game against Liverpool. However, I do think he's still going to be a Liverpool player. A Newcastle player when that transfer deadline comes. I can't see that deal happening. I'm not sure Liverpool feel the propensity to make that second bid. Otherwise, I think they would have done it by now.
Okay,
that's my personal opinion.
All right, interesting. Thank you very much indeed, Charlotte. Worth saying there is live commentary of another promoted team, Leeds United. They're back in the Premier League. They're playing Everton tonight and there's live commentary on TalkSport this evening. That was Charlotte Richardson of TalkSport. Now, let's go to the Italian Alps. There's been an increasing influx of tourists looking to escape, particularly post-COVID. They want the stunning views, the alpine breeze, and somewhere that looks very Instagrammable. The problem is, too many of them are doing quite difficult walks in light summer gear, and they're wearing flip-flops, not proper boots. And this is leading to the deployment of helicopters to rescue them. Tom Kington is the Times Italy correspondent. Is this a growing problem, Tom?
Well, I asked an official yesterday that exact question. He said, well, we don't know exactly how many more people are climbing the Italian Alps this year, but we can look at rescue statistics. And there were 8,000 a year rescues carried out before COVID. It's now up to 12,000. So that, however, doesn't necessarily mean a 50% increase in people, because it also means that there are more idiots. So you might have, you know, a growth in numbers, but also more people who really don't know what to do when they get to the top of a mountain.
I must be honest, I probably am an idiot when it comes to climbing the Dolomites. What are conditions like in the summer? Presumably there's no snow or hardly any snow left or no snow at all.
Well, you can find it if you look for it. But I think what's important is the fact that the weather can vary dramatically from minute to minute. So rescuers say that people who march up on a hot day in T-shirt and flip-flops suddenly can find themselves in a very cold squall and drenched, absolutely knackered and possibly lost, and suddenly, you know, they're on their phones calling for that helicopter.
And these helicopters clearly exist, but there can't be that many rescue helicopters, and I mean that's eating up Italian resources.
Well, that's what officials are moaning about, saying that it's draining their coffers. Their budget's pretty tight already. Sometimes people are actually charged for these operations, not always. But the point made to me was that it's also built on goodwill. A lot of these rescuers are volunteers, and they do it as a sort of sign of solidarity to mountain climbers. But that solidarity is in danger of being exhausted by the new kind of trekkers they're going out to rescue.
And these new kind of trekkers, they are often after that ultimate Instagram image, aren't they? And actually, it can often be very similar to an Instagram image taken by somebody else.
Well, that's precisely it. They want the precise same image that they've seen their favorite influencer to take. So you'll get queues forming at one lookout where they all want to get the picture that was put on Instagram by their favourite influencer. And maybe 200 metres down the path, there'll be a just as lovely a spot and there'll be no one there. But it's a kind of obsession to get that picture. And if there's a long queue, the mentality seems to be, I'll line up in the queue for an hour because that's the challenge. That makes the picture then sort of more worth it, which is, I think, a really tortured way of thinking.
Are you a hiker yourself?
Occasionally. I've got a bit of a dodgy knee at the moment, so I haven't been up a mountain this year. But there's plenty of great walking in Italy. And one of the things is that you don't have to go to the Alps. As I've written today, the head of the Italian Alpine Club was telling me rather kind of in a rather sort of sheepish way, because he didn't want the crowds to pick up on what he's saying. But he's saying if you go to southern Italy, Basilicata, Calabria, the mountains aren't as high, but they're just as beautiful and there's no one there.
Yeah. OK, well, you've told everybody now, Tom. Actually, Meloni is on her way to the States. She's going to be part of this extraordinary collection of European leaders meeting Trump and Zelensky later.
Correct. Yes, she's going to be there this evening. She was part of the video conference yesterday with Macron and Starmer and the other leaders. Italian media today was suggesting there was a little bit of friction between her and Macron during the call, because Macron is keen on sending in Western soldiers as a sort of peacekeeping force to Ukraine. Meloni's pet idea, which she's far more keen on, is offering Ukraine sort of NATO Article 5 security guarantees, even though Ukraine's not part of NATO. So you don't have to send in soldiers, but if there's any trouble from the Russians, the Ukrainians know they have a guarantee and they can call in Western support. Mm. So the two Macron and Meloni go at it like cat and dog.
Yeah, they're not friends, are they?
No. And there was a very funny bit in the paper this morning here saying, I don't know if it's true, saying that people near Meloni were saying that she's fed up with these video conferences with European leaders because Macron uses them just as a chance to show that he's the leader of Europe.
Oh, gosh. Right. OK. Well, of course, we all know he isn't. Thank you very much. That's Tom Kington, the Times Italy correspondent. Bit of an insight there into relations between the Italian and French leaders. Everything happening at the White House later. Full coverage here on Times Radio. Next, what is it good for, war? Well, apparently it's quite good for big business. Here are the headlines just after 2:30. James Kitchen.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. Donald Trump says it's a big day at the White House ahead of crunch talks with Vladimir Zelensky and European leaders. The US president added it's a great honour for America to host the meetings. Sir Keir Starmer is on his way to Washington, D.C. Speaking on the plane, he laid out his terms for a peace deal in Ukraine.
We've got to get this right. We've got to make sure there is peace, that it is lasting peace, and that it is fair and that it is just, because it's in everyone's interests, it's in the UK's interests, that we get this right.
European leaders are gathering in a show of support for President Zelensky. It comes just days after the US president's summit with Russia's Vladimir Putin in Alaska. There are reports it could pave the way for a trilateral summit between all three leaders. Senior politicians in Northern Ireland, Scotland and Wales are urging the Prime Minister to recall Parliament over the conflict in Gaza. They've written a letter to Sir Keir Starmer calling for immediate sanctions on Israel. A man's been found guilty for his part in a drive-by shooting which left a young girl with a bullet lodged in her brain. The 9-year-old had been eating at a restaurant in Hackney when she was hit last year. 33-year-old Jason Riley is guilty of 3 counts of attempted murder. Almost 2,000 soldiers are now helping to fight wildfires in the northwestern region of Spain. 27,000 people have been evacuated from their homes in Galicia. And a man's been bailed after reports of racist abuse directed at the Bournemouth forward Antoine Semenyo at Anfield. As part of his bail conditions, the 47-year-old from Liverpool has been banned from all football matches and stadiums in the UK. And for a news bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio. When you run a small business, you know it's important to keep an eye on your costs, and a smart meter can help.
Aaron Sarney's family own Twinkle Toes, the largest children's shoe retailer in Sheffield. He uses his smart meter to find ways to cut his energy costs.
Well, we chose to get a smart meter because what we didn't really know is what our daily consumption was. And so we just wanted to target, are there ways that we can actually go and see what we were using it on and that sort of thing. We have identified some areas where we've managed to save energy. The lights are used for 8 hours a day, so we can go and change the actual lighting to LED. And secondly, in the stockroom, for instance, if we introduce LED sensors, it will help reduce usage when no one's actually in the stockroom. Smart meter is a great tool. I would certainly recommend it to other businesses because it's certainly been a wonderful tool to help our business to actually understand our energy usage.
To find out more, search Get a Smart Meter for Business. Eligibility may vary.
Get the day's politics, business and sport every weekday in Breakfast from 6:30 a.m. This is Times Radio.
Good afternoon to you. This is Jane Garvey until 4 o'clock when John Pienaar takes over. John, it's going to be quite an interesting evening, to put it mildly.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. We're going to watch the whole thing play out in real time. Well, people miss nothing if they stay with us. We get the leaders around Europe arriving at around 5 o'clock, so an hour after we come on air. That sort of gaggle. What's a collective noun for presidents and prime ministers and a secretary general and a president of the commission? All of them turning up. As I guess, yes, a gesture of solidarity, but also a testament to the fact they don't quite know how far they can trust Donald Trump. No one's going to say that out loud, but that is the very obvious truth of all of this. And we'll find out maybe some clues to that an hour later. Stay with the show. And at 6 o'clock, we have Zelensky himself arriving, the two of them sitting down in that now famous, now gold-plated Oval Office.
Yep.
And taking whatever questions they may take.
Mm. J.D. Vance he was in Scotland. He's now gone back to the States.
Yeah, I think there'll be the Trump team will be there, so as they were the last time.
It can't be like it was earlier in the year.
No, you'd think it cannot. I mean, that was just such a shock to the system. The body language, Jane, is going to be as interesting as anything else. It's about what they say and how they say it, I think, as much as anything else. It won't be the beating up, the punishment beating that we saw in February when Zelensky was in the Oval Office, but how far will Trump demonstrate, make it plain that there's been this change of heart, change of mind that was so evident in Alaska? I mean, Keir Starmer, our own PM, praised what was said by the Prime Minister, by the President after that Alaska meeting, but he had shifted so significantly. He was basically echoing lines that could have come from the mouth of Vladimir Putin. And we'll see how far that is evidently the case today, although it won't be the end of the story.
No, I mean, we're just talking to Tom Kington, who's the Times man in Rome, and he was just saying that there's, to put it mildly, quite a lot of clear blue water between Macron and Meloni.
Yes.
Now, they're both going to be there. So not even our side of this can agree about what we can offer and how we can offer it.
Yeah, they may all, they'll turn up at the same time, but there are lots of fault lines in all of this. As I say, Meloni is one of the sort of Trump whisperers in the group. Macron, you know, haltingly so. Macron is more bullish when it comes to support of Ukraine. Meloni, the tone is slightly different. Merz, supportive of Ukraine, but not willing to back that up with the kind of stuff that France and Britain are willing to do by way of boots on the ground, if there's a ceasefire, and they can get boots on the ground, which, by the way, depends massively on whether America, whether Trump, is going to give some sort of security guarantee, whatever that may look like. So there are so many questions, and I don't think we're going to get anything like a huge number of answers, but just watching whatever we do see is going to be absolutely gripping.
Yeah, I'm sure you followed events on Friday. I know you were on your holes.
Yeah,
but
I did.
What struck you about it?
I was stunned by the way that Putin was greeted, as if his arrival in America was an unrivaled honour. The flypast of the stealth bomber with those jets on either wing. The way you greet the most honoured guest you could possibly imagine. And Putin, what struck me, I think, most of all, the single moment was when Putin approached President Trump towards that red carpet and Trump actually spontaneously burst into a round of applause, which I think told you all too much, not all of which we really wanted to see.
Okay, certainly one of the moments of 2025 so far. John, thank you very much. Good to have you back. John has been on his holidays, but very much back in position. And you can follow everything happening in the States in his company between 4 o'clock and 7 on Times Radio. Kate Borsay takes over after that. Now, Donald Trump's summit with President Zelensky and the European leaders begins, of course, in just a couple of hours. But regardless of the outcome, one thing is very clear. American unreliability means that Europe is rearming. Money is pouring into weapons industries as governments acknowledge that we are living in difficult, very, very challenging, insecure times. Let's talk to Henry Palmer, who's a venture capitalist and founder of the defence and supply chain fund Lightridge. Now, first of all, Henry, tell us a bit about Lightridge. What exactly do you do?
Well, Lightridge is an early stage venture capital firm. So we invest both in the US and UK and German markets predominantly. And we're very thematic. So we think about industrial resilience and security and target areas like materials, advanced manufacturing, logistics, dual purpose defense, really trying to drive innovation technology into those areas of the supply chain that we think are not only critical for the resilience of those economies and the security of those nation states, but also ultimately present a massive opportunity as we find ourselves in this transformational period. We think very much in like long arcs. It's as you'll know, venture capital, you're investing over 7-10 year horizons. Mm-hmm. So what we see is the breakdown of Pax Americana, the ending of this sort of unipolar world.
Right, which gives investors, organizations like your own, funds, the opportunity to invest in what and where?
So, I mean, to give you an example, we could look at in the materials space, the emergence of things like biosynthetics, the role of lab automation and robotics and AI, how this is stimulating entirely new areas of advanced alternative materials. And the various different ways in which that can mean transformational changes in our supply chain. So a very topical example would be things like REEs, rare earths, the ways in which we refine those materials, the way in which we mine or indeed entire alternatives to those materials.
We are told there are lots of those in parts of Ukraine.
Indeed. And, I think this is one of always the interesting things that we have to grapple with when we look at each of these markets. You mentioned Europe and the US decoupling, Europe having to do a lot more on its own, the kind of autonomy with which it has to act, the kind of influence it now has to impose upon its own sphere, the Atlantic, Russian border, Mediterranean. Europe has to think very differently about things to the United States. It has a different economy. It has different materials, different resources available to it. So, when we're investing, whether that's into the UK, German market, we think slightly differently than, say, if we were pursuing opportunities in the United States.
Right. But if you were, in very simple terms, for our listeners, many of whom might be thinking about retirement or thinking about their financial prospects for retirement, is now about the best time there's ever been to start investing in the defence industry?
Well, I can't advise, or give specific financial advice to anybody, but, For our fund, we very much look at a series of sort of emerging technologies around biosynthetics, AI, compute, the way in which these are going to transfer our economies, and then the impact those will have in different areas. I think defense, we all know Europe has increased its defense spending by 30% over the last couple of years. Interestingly, though, corresponding to that, output has not necessarily kept up. So sometimes you might look at a trend, say, on the defense side and see an opportunity as a venture fund to invest. But correspondingly with that, you also need to invest into industrial capacity, manufacturing technologies and so on, and the capacity and infrastructure that you need to support that and create the output at the same time. So, very much all of these things are sort of interconnected.
Right. I mean, does the defense industry in this country feel supported? I was going to say, does it feel loved? Because let's be honest, it's not particularly cuddly. In fact, some people find the whole thing abhorrent. What would you say about how it feels about what other people think of it?
Well, I think everybody has to take their own sort of ethical stance.
Yeah.
Generally, I believe the liberal democracies that we have, the institutions that we have, and the sort of privileges and rights we have require the ability to defend them. And that means that we have to do the dirty work of investing into these technologies and developing at the same time. So for me, the moral position is relatively clear, but every individual will have their own take. That being said, I think it is impossible not to recognize the more hostile world, that we're living in. And I think you have to face that with a certain amount of realism. One other thing that I think is often forgotten about defense is, of course, there's the production of specific weapons and weapons technologies. Defense has been one of the largest drivers of R&D and innovation of the 20th and 21st century of almost any sector. You know, so to name a couple of examples, you know, the internet being one of the most obvious.
Explain its origins were something to do with the American Navy.
It came out of R&D programs in the United States, largely to build an alternative communication platform, and the internet was the result of that. You know, I always. This is where we very much think of defense in dual-purpose terms, right? That you get a push-pull both from the civilian and the defense sectors when it comes to driving innovation that can have massive benefits for our economy, for our society, and so on at the same time. Another example I always love is the touchscreens that go into our iPhones. That technology was largely invented in the U.S., by Lockheed Martin and others in order to support fighter pilots operating in their jets. You know, it took Steve Jobs and Apple to figure out mm-hmm. how to put that into a consumer product and how to build a platform on top of it. But, I don't think we should underestimate the importance that defense plays in multiple different areas of our economy.
Okay, and just very briefly, in the incredibly limited amount of time available, have the phones at your company been running pretty hot? Have people been desperate to get in touch?
Well, you know,
because things are so terrible, frankly, because things look so bleak, is there bound to be increased interest in exactly what it is you're doing?
Absolutely. I think it's taken a little time, but in the same way that we see our politicians and our governments in Europe waking up to the new reality, so are, you know, ordinary people in the market, other, you know, investment firms, and indeed many founders. I think one of the things that's been very interesting and exciting to see is that a great wave of talent, you know, in their early 20s, entire new generation, who are ready to tackle, you know, what we think of as sort of hard tech areas, you know, in building new technology companies inside manufacturing, inside materials, inside, you know, defense sectors, in a way that maybe 4 or 5 years ago, you know, they wouldn't have. And I think this is a reflection of the sort of urgency and need that people feel, but also the fact that, it's an entire different topic. We could spend another 10 minutes or half an hour, hours on even, but AI has been proliferating through the software realm. But, you know, we're starting to see its impact on the atoms as well as the bits. And that, I think, is going to be transformational over the next decade.
Really interesting. Thank you very much indeed. That's Henry Palmer. He is the founder of the defence and supply chain fund Lightridge. You're with Times Radio. We're talking literary. Yes, we're going complete change of mood, change of subject. We're talking books with Laura Hackett in a moment. It is just after 3:15.
Early breakfast on Times Radio with Elavon. As a new day dawns, Times Radio connects you with the latest breaking news and provides intelligent opinion on all the morning headlines. Plus, get ahead of all the markets with updates, analysis, and insight with Times Radio's daily dedicated business bulletin. Early breakfast, every Monday to Friday morning from 5 on Times Radio with Elavon, your world of payments. Find out more at elavon.co.uk.
Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
At Viking, we believe travel should be more than just a trip. It should be a doorway to cultural insight and personal enrichment. Start planning your river, ocean, or expedition journey today and discover why Viking was named Best River Cruise Operator and Best Luxury Ocean Cruise Operator at the 2024 Times and Sunday Times Travel Awards. Learn more at viking.com.
When you're growing a small business, you need someone who understands the ins and outs. And whether you're a tailor or an accountant, you need the tools to succeed. With an HSBC Small Business Banking account, you'll have free accounting tools and access to our business specialists, virtually or in person. Because whatever your small business looks like, we're with you all the way. Search HSBC Small Business Banking account to get started. Subject to application, eligibility, credit check and T's and C's. Visit hsbc.co.uk for details.
This is Times Radio.
Now, the literary world, never far from the headlines, and the best-selling Irish author Sally Rooney has announced she'll donate her UK book royalties and proceeds from BBC adaptations of her work to the proscribed group Palestine Action. Writing in the Irish Times newspaper, she said, "If this makes me a supporter of terror under UK law, then so be it." I guess this is a reminder, if we needed one, of how writers and their work are often bound up with political debate. So let's open the French windows and start indulging ourselves, as we always do on a Monday afternoon, in the company of Laura Hackett, Deputy Literary Editor at The Times and The Sunday Times. She's been talking to me about what she's been reading lately, and we began our discussion with Katie Kitamura's most recent novel, only just out, actually. It's called Audition.
Kitamura she's an American writer, and she's probably best known for a novel called Intimacies. But this one, Audition, has been longlisted for the Booker Prize. So in my ambition to try and maybe read all of the longlisted ones, although some of them are very long, I decided I would give this a try. The basic story of it begins with this quite awkward lunch between an older actress, who's sort of our protagonist, we never learn her name, and a younger man called Xavier. And you're trying to figure out what's going on here. Are they on a date? Are they friends? What's happening? It turns out Xavier has become convinced that this woman is his mother, because years ago in an interview, she talked about giving up a child, and the interviewer interpreted that as she'd had the child and given it up. But she tries to tell him, no, I had an abortion. I didn't have the baby. You can't be my son. So we follow that sort of particular pattern, how they can work together, how her relationship with her husband is impacted. And then part two, everything changes. We see the same people, but now he is her son. And it sort of explores what the different roles we play, either on the stage or in real life, do to the relationships between people. So it's a bit of a tricksy one.
It is a trick. I mean, does it remind you a little bit of The Names, the Florence Knapp book?
A little bit, yes. It's definitely got a different vibe to it. This one, you're left much more uncertain about what's real and what's not. Whereas with The Names, I felt there was a very clear premise. We understood, okay, imagine if this happened.
It was a kind of sliding doors book, wasn't
exactly.
it? Exactly. And this is not dissimilar in a way?
It is and it isn't. But you're left wondering, are they both true? Is she losing her mind? Oh. What's happening? So yes, it's a really odd book. But I did still enjoy it, actually. I enjoyed trying to work out the puzzle, but I don't think I managed to crack it in the end.
Does it annoy you? And basically, I'm asking this because it annoys me. if we don't know characters' names.
It does a little bit, especially if you're writing a review selfishly, because the whole way through you're saying, the protagonist, then our narrator does. Yeah, and I'm like, can't we just have a name, please?
Don't they ever think of reviewers when they're writing?
I know, that's what I'm always saying.
Yeah, please bear it in mind when you're writing your books. I just find it slightly affected. But then I find lots of literary works a bit affected, which is why I'm drawn to Ken Follett. Take me up on that, Laura.
Well, I don't know. I mean, yeah, I also find it a little bit annoying when they don't have a first name, mainly because even when you're thinking about it, it's hard to conceptualise a person in your mind if you don't know their name, I think.
Weirdly, it is.
Yeah.
Now, this is something very different. Mary Chamberlain's Fen Women, originally published back in 1975, and a book with some kind of historical significance in terms of its publication. Tell me about this.
Yes, so this was the first book published by the feminist publishing house, Virago. They've gone on to publish many, many books, but this was the very first.
First ever book?
Yeah, that was when the publishing house was set up. Wait, and so this was their first one.
It says here, first non-fiction book published.
Oh, maybe.
Okay,
well, let's say first non-fiction book.
Okay, carry on.
So this was the first non-fiction book published by Virago, the feminist publishing house. And it's an oral history where this woman, Mary Chamberlain, she moved to the village of Isleham in Cambridgeshire in 1975. And she spent a long time speaking to all the different women and many of the different women in the village, some very old, some children, and finding out what their lives were like in a very rural, very isolated community that still suffered from a great deal of poverty. And it's absolutely fascinating, especially her conversations with the much older women, because they, of course, were Victorians, essentially.
Cool. And thinking
they've seen a huge amount of change happen. I mean, for instance, there was a village crier in this village until 1963.
So, someone who quite literally announced the news.
You pay a shilling to tell this man your news, and then he'd go round and shout it to everyone. This is 1963, and we think about the swinging 60s.
I was born the next year.
But it's remarkable that in sort of rural areas, everything was so different to how we have this view of history being A, meal, and B, quite city-centric. Mm. So this was really fascinating. There's a book by Ronald Blythe called Aikenfield. It's quite famous.
Oh, I've heard of that.
Yes, yeah. Where he did a similar thing where he interviewed lots of people in a Suffolk village and told this sort of history of the village and of its people. But what Mary Chamberlain thought was the women really didn't get the proper role that they should have in that book.
Which is, let's be honest, frankly, a lot more famous than Fen Women by Mary Chamberlain.
Yeah. And this was her feminist Aikenfield, she called it. And it's wonderful.
I really should have heard about this then.
Really good. And some of in the afterword, she goes back. She's still alive. Some of the women she interviewed are still alive. And she went back and spoke to them again.
I think we should get her on.
I think we should.
No, we should definitely get her on. I mean, I think this is absolutely fascinating because I do love to hear about, the real lives of real people, and presumably they talk a lot about their domestic lives.
Completely, yes. Yeah. So with the men in Aikenfield, so much of it is them talking about their craft and their work. With this, the women's work is just not even seen as work because it's often done in the home. It's never ending. You don't clock in and clock off. It's just a constant. But this sort of pays attention to that and gives it the importance that it's true.
And are these women angry or sad or just getting on with it?
It's a real mixture. There are lots of women who say, the older ones especially say, you know, it's so easy now and they don't understand. It was better when we didn't have as much. But then there are other people who said, no, we really, really suffered and we lived in poverty and it's good that things are changing. So it's fascinating to see people who've lived in similar situations but have completely different perspectives on it.
Okay, it just sounds really interesting. I mean, stuff like the invention of the washing machine. I mean...
Yeah.
Who would honestly want to live a life without one of those?
Well, some of them are saying, you know, if we had to put a wash on, we talk about putting a wash on, that was their entire day. They woke up first thing in the morning and in the evening they're still sorting it out. So it's just incredible that something like the washing machine changed lives just as much as the television or the radio, but it's just it was women's lives that were changed.
I really hope people do seek this book out. Has it got a kind of... enchanting cover, a kind of melancholic cover. Can
yes,
you describe
it's a lovely illustration of the sort of Cambridgeshire village, and it's a very nice anniversary edition with a new afterword and everything. I really, really enjoyed it.
Okay, I'm going to make sure I read it. That's called Fen Women. The author is Mary Chamberlain. Now, Anne Enright, really famous Irish writer, and as you were saying to me earlier, actually, significant because in some ways, because she stayed in Ireland. And, I mean, I'm not looking at you, although I am looking at you, Laura. Lots of people leave Ireland, and she hasn't, and presumably wouldn't.
No, she's spoken about how much this sense of being rooted in the same place where she grew up has really helped her with her writing, because it's given her this really strong imaginative foundation. If you know a place really well and you know the people really well, I think that really helps you as a writer, and it certainly seems to have helped her.
Well, she has a book out now. I've got a copy of it here, actually. It's called Writing on Life, Art and the World, Attention by Anne Enright. That's just been published, or is just about
to be published?
It's just
about to be published in a month or so, and that's a collection of essays about her writing life. So I'm just about to start that, but I thought in preparation I would go back and read one of my very favourite of her books, which is The Gathering, which was published in 2007 and won the Booker Prize that year. And it's a really remarkable book. It's narrated by a woman called Veronica. She is one of 12 siblings, 9 of whom are still alive, and she is gathering up her other siblings and her mother for the wake of her brother Liam, who has died in suspicious circumstances. We know that Liam was an alcoholic. We know that he was very troubled. And this book is basically Veronica's way of trying to figure out what is it that happened to Liam that made him the way that he was. And she suspects that there was something that happened a particular summer in their grandmother's house. And this book is her sort of forensically going back and trying to uncover it. So, as you can tell, it's not exactly light reading. There are really dark themes in it. But it's so beautifully written. And because it's Anne Enright, there's always humour in it. That's what I love about her, is that she can touch upon the darkest of subjects, but still manage to find light and laughter and often very black humour in it. And I just think she's brilliant.
Okay, where would you put Anne Enright when we're talking about contemporary Irish writers? I mean, she's got to be in the top. Well, I would say in the top five, easily, possibly easily. In the top one. I mean, yes. What would you say about that?
She's fantastic. I mean, before Edna O'Brien died, I always used to say Edna O'Brien is my favourite Irish writer of all time. But I think Anne Enright really, really is up there. Her and Colm Tabin might be my two favourite Irish authors, but it's so hard. There's so many great ones.
Okay, and this does sound accessible. So yes, any of us who've ever been to a funeral or had a family will be able to relate to this, particularly, I guess, because the Irish culture and the social scene there plays quite a big part in this. If you've got any Irish in you, you'll be able to relate to this.
Absolutely. And even if not, because it's about how families work and family dynamics as much as it's about living in Ireland.
Do you think this is her greatest book?
I personally prefer The Green Road, which is, it's similar in a way in that it's a family who've all come back together. The children are living across the world for one last Christmas in their old family home before their mother sells the house. And of course it goes disastrously wrong. So that I have a soft spot for, but I think this one most people say is her best because I guess it won the Booker Prize.
I'm going to set writers a challenge, and they need to have a book in which there's a huge family gathering in an important place and everything goes right.
Oh, that would be brilliant.
Well, yeah, nobody would read it.
It's just a nice dinner. They have great conversations.
Everyone gets on.
Yeah.
No, who'd read that? Laura, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Laura Hackett, and the books discussed there, The Gathering by Anne Enright, Fen Women by Mary Chamberlain, and Audition by Katie Kitamura.
Oh, it's doing so well. Katie Kitamura. That's the one that's a bit difficult to read, so maybe focus on the others. It's Times Radio. It is almost 3 o'clock.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Good afternoon, it is 3 o'clock and this is Jane Garvey on Times Radio until four. As world leaders arrive in Washington, we'll have the very latest on what is likely to happen in the Oval Office at that Ukraine summit. Practically everyone is going. If you've ever wondered what goes on behind the scenes, well, I'm going to be talking to a former White House social secretary. She's called Disha Dyer. She'll be with us after 3:30. And we'll have some royal news as well, as Prince William rules out starting his reign in a palace. We'll hear from the Sunday Times royal editor. First, the news at 3, James Kitchen.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. Sir Keir Starmer says Western allies must make sure there is a fair and just peace in Ukraine as he heads to Washington, D.C. The Prime Minister and other European leaders will gather at the White House later as Volodymyr Zelensky meets Donald Trump for talks on ending the war. In a social media post, President Trump says it's a big day at the White House, adding it's a great honor for America to host the meetings. Gideon Rackman is chief foreign affairs commentator of the Financial Times and author of The Age of the Strongman. He's been assessing the strategy of European leaders as they prepare to meet the US president.
I think they've developed a playbook really since that disastrous meeting between Zelensky and Trump the last time the two met in the White House. And that playbook is never contradict Trump, always play along with him, always talk up the positive. Nobody's going to say what you did in Alaska was a disgrace, even if they privately think that. They're going to say, wonderful, now let's build on it. And what these Europeans say is take Trump's big statement and then fill in the detail for him in a way we like.
Senior politicians in Northern Ireland, Scotland and Wales are urging the Prime Minister to recall Parliament over the conflict in Gaza. They've written a letter to Sir Keir Starmer calling for immediate sanctions on Israel. It comes as up to 50 critically ill and injured Palestinian children will be evacuated from Gaza to the UK for medical treatment in the coming weeks. Raza Halim is the co-founder of Project Pure Hope, which is involved in choosing the children who are to be flown to Britain.
It's an obviously heartbreaking exercise to go through, but it is a really critical one. Proper triaging in Gaza is critical to making sure that children who are triaged are children who can be properly saved. The UK has world-leading expertise when it comes to multidisciplinary approach to trauma patients, because the sad reality is many, many children simply won't be able to make it across the journey. The journey itself will be harmful. The injuries are too far gone.
A man's been found guilty of three counts of attempted murder after a shooting at a London restaurant in which a 9-year-old girl was shot in the head. 33-year-old Javon Riley was the getaway driver in Hackney last May. Three men were also injured in the attack, sparked by a rivalry between Turkish gangs in the capital. The gunman hasn't been caught. Detective Inspector Ben Dalloway says officers are pursuing a violent criminal network.
We have a reward of up to £15,000 for any information that leads to the identification, the arrest and the prosecution of this individual, but not just the shooter, anyone else who's involved in orchestrating this shooting.
A fourth person's been arrested following the death of a woman in Romford. Zara Salamukhtar was attacked on Chadwell Heath Lane on Saturday morning. A 35-year-old man continues to be questioned on suspicion of her murder, while three others are being held on suspicion of assisting an offender. And a man who was arrested for a racist abuse on Antoine Semenyo has been banned from every football stadium in the UK. The Bournemouth player reported the incident during the first Premier League game of the season against Liverpool on Friday. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Good afternoon. 3:04. It is just Jane Garvey until 4 o'clock. Feet is back from her holidays tomorrow afternoon here on Times Radio. Now, let's focus on the big news of the day. Ukraine's President Zelensky has accused Russia of demonstrative and cynical military strikes as he arrives in Washington to meet Donald Trump. The US president is, of course, pushing ahead with his plan to attempt to end the war in Ukraine. He is reportedly backing the idea that Zelensky could end the fighting by handing over land and cities in the east. European leaders, including Keir Starmer and Emmanuel Macron, are going to join the meetings in the next couple of hours, as you know. The former British ambassador to Ukraine, Lee Turner, told Times Radio Breakfast earlier that there are two main objectives for the European leaders to attempt to communicate to Donald Trump.
The first would be the importance of the principle that international borders must not be changed by force. This is a blindingly obvious bedrock of all of our security arrangements, to which President Trump inexplicably seems to pay no attention. And then the other thing that they'll be wanting to talk about is security guarantees.
That's Lee Turner, who used to be the British ambassador to Ukraine. Now, in a moment, I'll talk to the former Russian foreign minister, Andrei Kozyrev. First, let's get the latest from Stephen Erlinger, who is New York Times chief diplomatic correspondent. Stephen, we'll never forget what happened in the Oval Office back in February. It won't be like that again today, will it, when President Zelensky meets Donald Trump?
I shouldn't think so, partly because I think Zelensky's learned his lesson. Gideon Rackman described it properly. You just flatter Trump and flatter Trump and don't fight with Trump, certainly not when the cameras are on. That's the biggest mistake. And Zelensky has a point. He's had more of a relationship with Trump before. He's meeting him alone without the Europeans. I presume Trump will have other people with him too, first. So that's the danger zone. I think when the European leaders arrive for Chad and lunch, we'll have a better idea. But this idea that they would somehow protect Zelensky from Trump isn't really going to work. But the point is really that Putin very cleverly put the onus back on Zelensky, somehow convincing Trump that Zelensky was the problem to get to a peace treaty and a war Russia started. And part of what the Europeans are going to want to do is to reverse that onus of responsibility and make Trump realize it's Putin that wants to continue the war, and that Trump's first instinct was correct, which was you should have a ceasefire and then talk about land swaps and exchanges and not make those contingent on an end of the war, which means the war might never end.
Why is it that Donald Trump doesn't get that
Zelensky, really, it's very difficult to ask a man who didn't start a war to end it. Why does Trump stubbornly refuse to acknowledge this?
Well, Trump has, he's bought, in a way, the Russian narrative. I mean, he believes that with the Maidan and pushing for NATO enlargement, Ukraine somehow frightened Russia into starting this war. I mean, he believes that had Ukraine just kind of settled down into neutrality, maybe none of this would have been necessary. But after the Maidan in 2014 and the Russian annexation of Crimea, that was going to be impossible. I think Trump also sees Ukraine, much as Russia does, as something a little artificial, part of the Russian world somehow, the Russian civilizational world. And he's always had trouble with Zelensky ever since Trump's first term, when Trump had undergo an impeachment process. So I think he thinks Ukraine's in the way of his great, beautiful friendship with Putin and all the deals he can do with Russia. Trump is a real estate guy. He seems to think this is just a real estate deal and doesn't understand all that is involved in pushing a peace treaty down the throat of anybody.
And ultimately, he wants to prise Russia away from China, doesn't he? Or at least attempt to.
Well, that's their excuse. I mean, sure. But I mean, I think that's really secondary. I think he believes that, you know, there are three big powers in the world, China, Russia, and the U.S., and he wants decent relationships with both of them. I don't think it's, you know, people keep talking about the way Nixon and Kissinger worked on China. That was a long time ago. China's pretty invested in Russia not losing this war, and Russia's quite invested in its partnership with China. So if that's their notion, I think it's just not going to work.
What do you think are the chances of a meeting after today with Putin, Zelensky and Trump all together?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, Trump really wants it. Zelensky would be happy to do it. It's Putin who has resisted it regularly and said it's impossible because, you know, Zelensky, in his view, is an illegitimate president of an artificial country. But I think if Trump pushes Putin hard enough, then, you know, it is possible. I don't rule it out at all.
And something I was discussing earlier with my colleague John Pienaar, that image of Donald Trump bursting into spontaneous applause on the red carpet in Alaska on Friday, what do you make of that?
Well, Trump has always liked Putin. Putin is very good at being liked. If you remember, George W. Bush said he looked into his soul and, you know, liked him. Putin is very well trained at giving people a notion of warmth and of a relationship. I mean, that's what he does. He's also very good at finding people's weaknesses and vulnerabilities. He's a trained agent that way. So I do think Trump likes the strongman idea. He feels Putin is a good leader who's restored a lot of credibility to his own country, who doesn't have to worry about meddlesome judges and politics.
Voters, yeah.
And voters, yeah. That's right.
Thank you very much for your time, Stephen Erlinger, who is New York Times chief diplomatic correspondent. It looks as though Keir Starmer has arrived in Washington ahead of those talks. He's just one of the European leaders who's going to be in and around the Oval Office a little bit later. We'll have all the coverage for you here on Times Radio. Let's have a word with Andrei Kozyrev, who was Russian foreign minister between 1990 and 1996. Mr. Kozyrev, what do you think is likely to be the mood in that initial meeting between Zelensky and Trump today?
Very good. I'm sure it's not a red carpet, but pretty good mood. Yes, mood. Okay.
The mood will be all right. Okay, so it won't be anything like what unfolded back in February.
No, I don't think so. Nobody needs that. And Zelensky has a new jacket, so... No, no. The, okay. The, I mean, images would be okay.
Yeah, actually, it's quite interesting that you mention his clothing. It will be quite interesting to see what Zelensky is wearing in way of a jacket today. We'll keep an eye on that. So what do you make of Donald Trump's diplomatic efforts? Because he has many critics in this country, but we probably all should acknowledge that he is apparently determined to stop the fighting and the loss of life in that war between Russia and Ukraine. And he deserves credit for that, doesn't he?
Yes, of course, it looks that way. The problem is that for a long time, you know, before President Trump came into the office for this time, for second term, in Washington, the upper hand, I think, had a appeasement party. Those who thought somehow they decided that Ukraine should concede territories to Russia because Russia is, I think this is the main reason, because Russia is a nuclear superpower, which it is, like America. But that's completely wrong. Putin wants to be a conqueror of Ukraine and of many other countries in Europe, which was signaled by, I don't know, it was probably a hint just by Lavrov, the foreign minister, who came to Alaska in a sweater or whatever this with a USSR.
Yeah.
That is, he had big Cyrillics, but that was the USSR. So probably he wanted even to warn Americans, and knowing that it would be showed all over the world, warned that it's not just an ambition of Putin to take part a piece of Ukraine or and stop somewhere there or the whole Ukraine. His ambition is recreate more or less the Soviet Union. So next probably will be the Baltic states, which were also like Ukraine, inside the Soviet Union, were considered integral parts of the Soviet Union, and they are now in NATO. So if NATO and the West cannot give Ukraine weapons to repel the aggression, not only to tolerate seizure of their territories, but to repel the aggression, then Putin will have clear signal that he can go to Baltic states. And assurances, yes, it's in the center of discussion now, but assurances or guarantees, it's very difficult to think of guarantees against aggression, military aggression, brutal aggression.
Well, we're hearing today that our British Prime Minister says, you know, there is a real possibility of British forces on the ground in Ukraine. Do you believe that?
I would believe that if more British weapons, especially long-range missiles and other powerful weapons, which UK, of course, has, if those were now on the ground in Ukraine, helping Ukraine to push back. But since they are not there now, I mean, it's very difficult to imagine. And also, let us not forget that Putin is in power for 25 years, while European leaders and the American presidents change every now and then. So what kind of guarantees, the only guarantees which would matter, would be ratified guarantees. And imagine a discussion in the House about that.
Put simply then, you believe that President Putin understands only one thing, really, and that is force. And the West actually is simply unwilling to use it.
No, yes, only, but not only willing, but uses it. Yeah. That's the problem.
So talking is one thing, but doing appears to be something else.
Absolutely.
Interesting. Thank you very much indeed. Sorry, carry on. Difficult line there, I'm afraid. We should say that Andrei Kozyrev does live in the United States. He's a former Russian foreign minister, so apologies there. Bit of a delay on the line, but we're very grateful to him for giving up his time. Times Radio throughout the day will have expert analysis, previewing and reacting to whatever comes out of those meetings in the White House later on. John Pienaar takes over at 4 o'clock, of course, and he'll have the Times Radio Drive. He'll be talking, amongst other people, to the Times Washington correspondent, George Grills. So Keir Starmer has just arrived in the White House, although, as Stephen Erlinger was saying earlier on in that conversation, the New York Times chief diplomatic correspondent, he didn't seem entirely certain that the European leaders would have an enormous impact on what is decided today, if anything. Now, the Prince of Wales is going to be the first monarch when he comes into that role not to live in a castle or a palace. William, Kate and their children are trading in their cottage for a place called Forest Lodge in Windsor Great Park, which has 8 bedrooms. This is the prince presenting a dilemma. Well, this, I should say, comes at a time when the prince has another dilemma, at least one for his friend, the Duke of Westminster. I hope you're keeping up with this, because I'm not sure I am. He's reportedly trying to work out if William or his estranged brother Harry should be godfather to his newborn baby daughter. That is a dilemma, certainly, for the Duke of Westminster. Roya Nika is the Sunday Times royal editor. Hello, Roya, how are you?
Hi, Jane, very well. How are you?
Good, thank you. First of all, please tell us about these new domestic arrangements for William and Kate. Remind us, where do they live now? And then tell us where they're going to.
So they currently live in Adelaide Cottage, which isn't a cottage, like it sounds. It's a very nice big house on the Windsor estate. But they are going to move later this year to Forest Lodge, which is a much bigger house. Still quite nearby Windsor Great Park. But I think the interesting thing about it is not really kind of the upgrade in bedrooms. It's more the idea that, you know, it's been made very clear from William's camp that this will be the home that he lives in when he's king. When Kate is queen, without any live-in staff and not in a palace or a castle, which is a bit of a departure from monarchs since medieval times. So it's a bit of a change there. And I think that's the sort of message they want to send in terms of doing things a bit differently to the current king.
Right. I mean, I confess, I'm slightly losing track of how many properties there are in Windsor Great Park.
Too many, Jane.
I know. Well, I'm absolutely bamboozled. I honestly didn't know. I've never heard of this place. How long has it been around?
None of us had actually heard of it.
Oh, right.
There was sort of chat a couple of months ago that they might be moving to a different property, another one that none of us had heard of. And then, of course, you've got Andrew up the road at Royal Lodge. I know that all sorts of houses up their sleeves to pull out the hat. But I think ultimately, you know, the interesting thing about this is I think it's sort of William showing that he doesn't really want to be wafting around an uninhabited castle when he's king, just because he's king. And it gets, you know, at the end of the day when the king and queen, they'll be able to shut the door on the flunkies and try and have a slightly quote-unquote normal life, as normal as life can be.
Right, yes, albeit with 24-hour security, which, in fairness to them, I wouldn't wish on anybody. I understand that's tough. But is this costing the taxpayer anything?
No, it's not. And that's the other sort of thing they've been quite keen to stress. It's you know, the taxpayer paid an awful lot of money, about £4.5 million a few years ago to refurb Kensington Palace for them. And they didn't end up staying there for very long. They moved up to Norfolk and then moved down to Windsor. And I think they're very keen to sort of avoid the optics of that again. So this is the renovation is all being funded from William's own pocket.
Okay, well, that's reassurance of a sort.
As it should.
Yes, well, quite, said everybody. I don't think anybody listening in the nicest possible way would want to chip in, but we do wish them the best. Now, what about this dilemma, this real social dilemma for the Duke of Westminster, who is, I'm gathering here, it says here, the 14th richest man in the UK. So he's not actually doing as well as I thought he would be, but who to pick in terms of the brothers?
I saw that Shane Watson's done a wonderful follow column today of my piece yesterday, asking exactly this: who would you pick, William or Harry? Well, Hugh Grosvenor is pretty much the closest friend to the brothers, and one of the very few friends who's been able to stay in touch with both of them post fallout. And he's in a sort of position where, you know, I did a story last year that William was an usher at his wedding. Harry didn't come in the end because it was all considered far too awkward. But Harry and William are both godfathers to, Hugh is godfather to both of their children, Archie and George. So I think Harry would hope he'd be made godfather. But given the status quo, it's a little bit dicey. He's just had his first baby, a daughter called Cosima. I know it's a first world problem, but I think at the heart of it, it sort of shows the wider impact of the ongoing tension in the royal family and how tricky it's made things for people.
Yes, I mean, they've never been entirely functional. I mean, which family truly could describe itself as functional, I guess, but they've got the Andrew problem and the fact that these two once close brothers just don't speak to each other. And is it nowhere near being sorted out?
I have to be honest and say, Jane, no, it's not. I mean, my understanding is they haven't actually spoken to each other in person since 2022, 3 years ago. I mean, yes, Harry came to the coronation very briefly. He didn't even, come back to the palace afterwards. And it's as frosty as it has been for a very long time. I mean, I know Harry gave that interview back in May to the BBC saying he wants a reconciliation with his family. But I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon with William. He is due back in a few weeks. He will be here in a few weeks going to the Well Child Awards in early September. The huge question mark will be whether or not he sees the king, who he's not seen since last February. But there's, at the moment, still a total standoff between the brothers.
Right. It's actually really, really sad, ultimately. Thank you very much indeed. That's Roya Nika, who is royal editor of the Sunday Times and had that exclusive story about the godparents' dilemma for the Duke of Westminster over the course of the weekend. Now, Off Air with Jane and Fee will come your way tonight at 6 o'clock. I've been co-hosting with the wonderful Jane Mulcairns for the last week or so while Fee's been away, but she will be back for tomorrow's edition. Though I have to say, Jane has been impeccable as ever. And in Off Air, you can hear all of our 3:30 interviews in full. Over the last week or so, we've had Nicola Sturgeon, Celia Imrie. I also talked to the novelist Val McDermott, who is actually a friend of Nicola Sturgeon, and she talked to me about the struggles seemingly faced by all female politicians.
There's a dark level of misogyny targeted against politicians in Scotland, women politicians. I've seen the kind of things that get said to Nicola on a regular basis. I mean, appalling slurs, sexual abuse. It's continuous. And I have to say that much of the Scottish media just piles onto this. And I know that that's addressed to other women in politics as well. I know a few women politicians, and they all say the same thing. They get the kind of abuse that is not targeted at male politicians. And it's not just in Scotland. I mean, this happens in Westminster too. If I was saying, a young woman came to me and said, I'm thinking of going into politics, I'd say, think again, think long and hard about it, because you won't find a welcome there.
The novelist Val McDermott, she has a new Karen Piri book coming out in October, and she was a guest on Off Air last week. You can download that episode and indeed many other editions wherever you get your podcasts from. Now let's talk money, let's talk personal finance. And in an effort to revive dwindling sales, British motorists can now lease a Tesla electric vehicle for nearly half the price it cost a year ago. With Tesla's market share declining across Europe and increasing competition from cheaper Chinese rivals, Elon Musk's EV company has been compelled to offer discounts of up to 40% to car leasing firms. Let's check in with Holly Mead, host of the Times Feel Better About Money podcast. Holly, I mean, that's quite the discount. What's happening here?
Oh, what a bargain. A Tesla for about £400 a month, apparently, you can get one for now if you go through leasing.
Wow.
Which sounds great, doesn't it?
Well, it also sounds quite a lot, in fairness.
It does. There are cheaper cars available, sure. Maybe with longer driving ranges as well.
Yeah.
I think, it's interesting, isn't it? It kind of shows you where Tesla is at and that the sales slump is concerning them, particularly as the technology improves and so competitors do better. But I think this leasing thing definitely needs to be researched for anyone who's thinking about going down that route. Actually, if you want to buy an EV, if this is available to you, probably the most efficient way that you can do that is if your company offers a salary sacrifice scheme.
Right.
And that is a sort of way of getting a benefit in kind from work where you agree to artificially lower your salary in exchange for a benefit. And in this case, it can be a company car, not a company car, but a car you lease through your company. And then you're kind of paying that lease before paying your tax.
Yeah.
So that is a real saving. So anyone who's thinking about buying a new car could consider that as an option. There are downsides to doing salary sacrifice, of course, because it is artificially lowering your wage. If you're about to apply for a mortgage, that will affect your affordability. And also if you're about to go on maternity leave, because that is done by your average earnings, that would affect that too. So you definitely need to do some weighing up of the pros and cons. And then I also think for anyone who's looking at the leasing route, the PCP route, so the traditional car financing, is another alternative, where often the monthly payments are lower.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because with this style of finance, you have that balloon payment at the end where you have the option to buy the car outright, or if there's any equity in it after your 3-4 year of payments, then you can use that kind of as an installment on the next route. So bargains to be had, perhaps, with a very small B. But okay. I think there's a lot of ways that you can buy a car, and there's a lot of cheaper cars out there.
Well, yeah, there really are. Let's talk about the value of a financial advisor. Lots of people use financial advisors, but how do you know you've got a good one, and how much should you pay, if anything?
Well, it's definitely not a good one if you're not getting richer. No. It's so hard, because also the way that financial advisors do their fees, it's usually what they'll do is charge you a percentage of the sort of wealth that they're looking after for you. So it's quite hard to kind of compare. I think the thing always with taking financial advice is to go in with your eyes open. Be wary of anyone who's not giving you a proper detailed breakdown of where all of those layers of fees and charges are going. If you don't understand it, if they're trying to obfuscate, do not do it. And a lot of advisors will offer you a service where they offer annual reviews and you pay an ongoing charge for that year in, year out. Now, unless your affairs are particularly complicated, it's probably the case that you don't need an annual checkup on your financial affairs. So you can usually ask to just turn that service off and then just pay for ad hoc advice as and when you need it. And okay. Some will do that for a flat fee as well. So you might pay a couple of £1,000 and someone will put this whole financial plan into action for you and sort your pension out and tell you if you need any insurances and look at where all your savings are and whether they could be doing anything more efficiently. But you kind of pay that as sort of a one-off, and then maybe you come back in 5 or 10 years time when you're closer to retirement or you're closer to clearing the mortgage, so life has changed and you need that reassessment.
Okay. And is there a minimum amount that you have to have at your disposal before a financial advisor will give you any of their time?
It varies, and it might be that you have a lesser level of service available to you, which, to be fair, if you've got not an awful lot, then in savings or in wealth, then it's probably that your affairs aren't overly complicated and you don't need those sort of very detailed service plans. Some advisors will not touch anyone unless they have £100,000 in ready money. So it will vary, but others, you know, will attend to your needs, whatever you want. I think the best thing always is to try and find a recommendation from a trusted family or friend.
Yeah.
Because, you know, online reviews are great, but they can kind of be misleading or might not kind of represent what you specifically need. And I also think when you're looking for a financial advisor, don't be afraid to date a couple and then ditch them, you know, have that initial meeting with them, and you don't have to stick with them if you just don't feel that rapport or just don't think they're for you. So you shouldn't ever feel pressured and you should never feel locked in.
Okay, Holly, good advice. Thank you very much indeed. How to Feel Better About Money is the name of Holly Mead's Times podcast. Feel Better About Money rather than How To. It's available now and it's very accessible and it's always really interesting. Now, the big interview coming up is with Disha Dyer, who used to be the social secretary at the White House when the Obamas were there. That should be interesting. Let's check in on the newsroom, get the headlines here on Times Radio from James Kitchen.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. Sir Keir Starmer has touched down at Joint Base Andrews as he says Western allies must make sure there is a fair and just peace in Ukraine. The Prime Minister and other European leaders will gather at the White House later as Volodymyr Zelensky meets Donald Trump for talks on ending the war. Elizabeth Brough from the Atlantic Council says it'll be a vital show of unity.
We have centre-left leaders like Keir Starmer, we have right-wing leaders like Giorgia Meloni, but what matters is they're essentially signalling we are there to support Ukraine, and that is what matters most.
Meanwhile, 10 people have been killed in Russian strikes on the Ukrainian cities of Zaporizhia and Kharkiv, with the youngest being a one-year-old girl. Elsewhere, senior politicians in Northern Ireland, Scotland and Wales are urging the Prime Minister to recall Parliament over the conflict in Gaza. They've written a letter to Sir Keir Starmer calling for immediate sanctions on Israel. A man's been found guilty for his role in the drive-by shooting of a 9-year-old girl who's been left with a bullet in her brain. 33-year-old Javon Riley was the getaway driver in the attack, which was part of a violent Turkish gang rivalry. The gunman's still being sought. A fourth person's been arrested following the death of a woman in Romford. Zawaz Salah Mukhtar, who was 27, was attacked on Chadwell Heath in East London on Saturday morning. And more than 200 British pubs closed in the first half of the year. Analysis of government figures reveals they were demolished or converted for other uses. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
I believe those who are curious see the world differently. At Viking, we have always been curious and quite a bit different. For over 25 years, we have been connecting the thinking person with the world. First on the great rivers, then on all five oceans, now on all seven continents. We are One Viking, exploring the world in comfort.
As a small business owner, you've got to be ready for the ups and the downs. Ready to think on your feet, ready to be rushed off your feet, ready to make the big decisions and make the tea. Two sugars in mind? Ta. Ready to be there for your customers whenever they need you. Well, ditto. Virgin Media Broadband's ready for anything business can throw at it. Yeah, it's business ready broadband. Search Virgin Media Business Broadband.
Wow, Direct Line sorted my claim with a 5-year guarantee on the car repairs. That's how it's done. Imagine if that's how everything got done. Like getting my kids to eat their greens.
Mummy, the vegetable van is here. Please can I have a broccoli pop? Or a courgetto? Please?
Go on then.
Direct Line, that's how it's done.
Valid whilst the car is yours. Must use approved repairers. Excludes poor maintenance, later damage, wear and tear.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
It's 25 minutes to 4. Good afternoon to you. This is Jane Garvey on Times Radio until 4 o'clock. All the big news of the day, of course, is going to come out of the United States and specifically out of the White House. We know that European leaders are about to arrive. Well, I say about, they've got another 90 minutes or so before they convene at the White House. And then the President, President Trump, is meeting and greeting President Zelensky at around 6 o'clock our time. And so it goes on through the course of the evening with all the coverage here on Times Radio in the company of John Pienaar from 4 and then Kate Borsay with you from 7 o'clock tonight. You won't miss anything. Somebody who knows all about these big occasions at the White House is my guest now. It's Disha Dyer, who's written a book called Undiplomatic, How My Attitude Created the Best Kind of Trouble. And she was the White House Social Secretary under President Obama. Disha, really good to speak to you. How are you today?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's really, really interesting to talk to you. It'd be interesting at any time, but particularly at a time when everyone is looking at the White House. I think we just need to know from you, what does a social secretary do? So would you be involved in a kind of political diplomatic event like the one that's happening today?
Yes. So the social secretary does everything that is actually happening in the executive mansion. So that includes obviously the White House, so the East Wing and the West Wing. So what the social secretary would do would help welcome the leaders there, make sure that their comforts are taken care of, make sure that the press is in the room for the right things, make sure the cars are lined up with Secret Service. So it's a lot of details and logistics, but we basically, our job is to make sure that the meeting goes off without a hitch from a hospitality and a comfort standpoint. We are not in charge of the actual substance of the meeting.
Right. Yeah, but you would know, let's say there was a European leader coming over and they had a nut allergy. You'd know about it.
Yes, 100%. We'd know about that. We'd know what they like, what they don't like, what offends them, what doesn't offend them. So we would know all of that to make sure we obviously didn't have any more reasons to look a bigger spotlight on the White House today.
Right. I mean, I just cannot imagine what you felt like the night before one of these big set piece events. I mean, did you get any sleep at all?
No sleep. If I was even sleeping at home, because sometimes I slept in my office. And so there was no sleep because there's not a chance to redo these things again, you know, and the whole world is watching. So you have to remember that any mistake, any small little thing, any good thing is going to end up, you know, being the topic of conversation the next day or on the front of the paper. So there was never a do-over, which means that I had anxiety through the roof.
Okay. I mean, it's just a fascinating experience that you've had in that role. Tell us a little bit about how you got it, because I was really interested to read that you started as an intern. But you were relatively senior, weren't you? I mean, you're not old now, but you were in your 30s when you were an intern.
I was. I went back to college, to university in my 30s, well, in my late 20s. And this man, Barack Obama, started to appear kind of all over, just not even American media, but global media. And for the first time, I saw someone that I identified with in politics, which I hadn't before. And I was a community activist and very involved in local things in my community. And I said, I want to figure out how to work for him, you know, but it was a joke. It was kind of like you just say things, you know, talking to your friends. And I got an application for the White House internship. And it was really stated that, you know, it was for people that were in school and community service oriented and all these things. And I said, I know I'm out of age, the typical age for an intern, but I'm going to apply anyway. And I applied when I was 30 and then got the internship at 31.
So Barack Obama politicized you, or but you say you were already working in the community. So tell us about your early life, where you went to school.
Yes. And so I went to school. I went to a private boarding school for kids that were from basically financial, you know, inadequate families. So I grew up kind of poor. And, you know, I went to university the first time as a 17-year-old, did not like it, did not understand why I was there and why it cost so much money, didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. But I was very involved in the HIV/AIDS movement because I didn't really connect the policy of politics with what was going on in the community. I didn't have that natural connection. And so, you know, I went to school, dropped out, and then got involved with HIV/AIDS, and then got involved with the hip hop culture, writing about women in hip hop and women in music, had a job. And then I realized that I wanted to be a social worker and I wanted to work solely with marginalized and poor communities, which meant that I had to go back to school. Right. So that is what started it all. And then I eventually then, you know, got the internship at the White House and took my political dealings to a whole new level.
Okay. I mean, you write a lot in the book about imposter syndrome, about feeling that wherever you were never quite right, never quite good enough, didn't behave in a way that was quite as it should have been. And I really want you to just outline what it was like at that school you went to, because Hershey is a major chocolate manufacturer, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, it is.
And they sponsored the school that you went to?
Yes. And so Milton Hershey and Catherine Hershey, they could not have children. And so they started a boarding school for orphan boys in 1919. And the school then grew to be from orphan boys that then included, you know, girls, then people of color. And then it had to be where your family fit under a certain income level. So you basically had to be very much under the poverty line to go to the school. And the school's a boarding school. So you live with 16 other, I live with 16 girls all of my life. You don't grow up with your parents. You live in the middle of, you know, a cow field that, you know, there's cows and chocolate everywhere. But it wasn't a space that I felt comfortable because it wasn't a space that kind of embraced diversity. They're a lot better now, but I went in 1987, so it was a little bit different. And that kind of planted the imposter syndrome for me of, I just don't belong. I don't know where I belong. And that continued throughout, you know, until my adulthood.
I must admit, I can understand why you thought you'd be the world's least likely White House intern, I guess, in some ways. I mean, I imagine, I mean, I'm obviously not American, but I would imagine that White House interns were overwhelmingly, what, Harvard and Princeton type people. Would that be right?
That's very correct. I think that that's definitely the sentiment, and not only the sentiment, I think that that is true, where, you know, those people who go to those schools or come from families that are big donors to political parties, they get access to things and they also get privilege to things that other of us don't get. And so when I went to the White House, especially my first day, I definitely was thinking, everybody's going to know that I'm in community college, which is junior college, and I'm 31 years old. But to be honest with you, everyone's nervous. Everyone was nervous and wondering how they got there. It wasn't just me.
Well, you've got to tell a story of your first kind of toe-curling encounter with President Obama, because you were on his plane, weren't you?
Yes. I was on Air Force One as an intern because I was, you know, I was older. So I got a lot of work that a lot of interns didn't get and a lot of responsibilities. Yeah. And so we were on the plane flying home from Texas, and the president comes around Air Force One and he always greets everyone and says hello. Well, obviously he knows who, you know, everyone is at the senior advisors and military and Secret Service. And it got to me, and, you know, I got introduced to the aide. The aide said, "This is Deesha Dyer. She's one of our interns." And the president just said, you know, "Oh, nice to meet you." He's like, "I didn't know that interns, you know, flew on the plane." And he said it in a very jovial, lighthearted, fun way. But I just said to him, "I'll jump out." So I just, you know, I don't know what I was thinking in the air. And he just put his hand on my shoulder and said, "Just nice to have you here." And it was so embarrassing that I was like, I'm never going to talk to this man again. And obviously I did, but yeah, well, it was so embarrassing.
You weren't to know at the time that you were going to talk to him again. I mean, was that a conversation that you then relived time and time again in your head for weeks afterwards?
I still relive it, and that was 15 years ago. I still think to myself, that was so stupid that I said that, you know. But I think that he was kind of just, you know, taken back and probably knew that I was really nervous and just kind of played along.
Yeah, what were your fellow interns like? Were there some of them who really were from kind of central casting and the sort of person I might expect to be there?
Mm-hmm. You know, there were a lot of them, honestly, who were just like me, who went to regular schools or community colleges that came from military. But there were some whose parents had been involved in the Democratic Party for a very long time, or they were very high donors. But the interesting thing was, is once we got there, mostly all those interns were the same as me, being like, "How did I get here?" Even though they knew how they got there, they didn't know what they were doing either. None of us knew, you know, because it was the first year of the presidency. They were 19, 20. I was 31. And we were all just like, "I can't believe we're here." But they ended up all being wonderful and great. And we're still friends to this day. So, yeah.
You've had such an interesting career. I mean, it's just worth saying that the internship finished and you kind of resumed your normal life again. But then you got back into the White House. How did that happen?
You know, I went back, you know, because a job became open. It was the job of the supervisor of the interns in my department. So it was the person I reported to as an intern. And when the head of the department said, "Who do you all suggest for this role?" The majority of the department scheduling in advance said, "Deesha needs to be chosen for this. And Deesha's so good." And they called me. And when they called me, I originally said no, because I was afraid that they were going to find out that I didn't have a college degree, which is acceptable when you're an intern, not really acceptable when you are a staffer. And so I initially said, I don't think this is for me, until I was honest about, you know, I was still in school. And they said, that's fine. We can figure out a way for you to continue going to school. And I did. And then I eventually graduated 2 years later after starting the White House job.
Okay. I mean, that is remarkable. Was the pay good?
No, the pay was not good at all. I think that, you know, relative to what some people do make, I'm sure it was, you know, it's better. But the whole thing is that you're working at the White House. And so your next job is supposed to be the good paying job that you get after you work at the White House. But compared to the number of hours that we worked, it was not comparable at all. I hope it's higher now.
Yeah. I mean, you are honest in the book. How much did you earn at the point at which you left? How much were you earning?
I was earning $118,000 once I left. And we were the lowest paid. I was the lowest paid social secretary along with my predecessor. So they went back up to about 152, 175 after we left. But we made a little bit lower than that.
Yeah. I mean, look, it's a decent salary, but it's not a lot for the responsibility. That's for sure. We know that, I mean, we're keeping an eye, obviously, in London on what's going on in the Oval Office, and people are very interested. At the moment, in the Trump administration, everything seems to run late. Did it run late in your day, or is this a Trumpian thing?
This is the Trump thing. It definitely did not run late for us. The Obamas did not ever want to be embarrassed that things were late. And Mrs. Obama actually runs extremely early. President Obama runs on time. And so we were, from the military to the front office to all of us, we communicated nonstop to make sure that things did not run late. And we also didn't run it reported in the press that, you know, we were late or this leader was late, because it'll be twisted as that's a sign of disrespect. But when the Trumps came to visit after their win, because they come to visit the White House right after, they actually were early. And that was probably the only time that they were early when I dealt with them.
Yeah, you also dealt with them on that morning in 2017, wasn't it? The January 2017, when they came, because that was Trump's inauguration day. But you were still running the choreography of what went on at the White House. And something went wrong there, didn't it? Because Melania turned up with a gift and she wasn't supposed to.
She wasn't supposed to have a gift simply because we did not know about it. So giving a gift from First Lady to First Lady is very common. Mrs. Obama did it to Mrs. Bush, but it's awkward when you don't know about it and everything is coordinated. So we would have known about it. We would have had somebody get it and bring it inside or whatever. But there were two things. And not only did we not know, but it was also like a Tiffany's box. And so it was like an advertisement for a business, which we also didn't do. So it was just very awkward. And we laugh about it now, but I was definitely freaking out then because it was my last event. And I was like, how could this mess up like this? You know?
I mean, what was the mood that morning? I imagine somewhat bleak from your perspective.
It was bleak, but I think that we also at that point we just gave a big sigh, you know, saying we've done all that we could do. I think the more emotion that came out was saying goodbye to each other, goodbye to the Obamas, and goodbye to the resident staff, you know, the cooks and the butlers and the ushers, the people that had taken care of them for, you know, 8 years. That was the really, I think that kind of, you know, that kind of overrid any kind of upset feelings. I think we were all scared for the country and we knew that it was not going to be good. But at the same time, we had a job to finish. And so we were going to finish that job. We were going to, you know, celebrate with each other the last 8 years and we were going to say goodbye with dignity. And that's what we did.
Yeah. Do you think, as many people do, that Donald Trump became president because of President Obama?
100%. I do believe that. I believe that the country was making sure that we would never have a black president. a president that's even, you know, close to any kind of democratic and equal values as Barack Obama. I think that if we did not have, Barack Obama, we probably wouldn't have both terms of Trump. And I do believe that 100%.
But how, I suppose that begs the question, how did Obama get elected? What went right then?
You know, the thing about President Obama is, I don't know if you've ever met him, but President Obama is he's congenial, but he gets stuff done. And I think that the country believed and they knew that this is somebody that did not come from the same pedigree as so many other of our politicians or our billionaires or our 1%. And so he was more like them. And people saw that. People saw that common ground in who he was, even if he was not of the same ethnicity, race, or background. And he was able to really, to bring that out in people and say, even though we're different in these ways, we have so many more things in common as just regular people. And I think that stuck. You know, he's very charming. He knows how to use his words. He knows how to use his actions. People love him from across the board. But I think what happened was it was a little too much and it scared people a little too much. And then that kind of, was like, we're going to take every opportunity to make sure that does not happen again. And that's what we're seeing right now.
Right. So do you think President Obama in any way blames himself for Donald Trump?
Absolutely not. I don't think it's a blame situation. I think it is because he would have done all that he did over again. Like, he ran on his principles and ran because he wanted to. I don't think it's a blame thing at all, because it's not on him. I think it's on the reaction of the rest of the country. That's who should be blamed. Those who can't see that, that a Black man could be president, that we could have equal rights. And so I don't think he blames himself at all for Donald Trump. And I don't think anybody really blames him. I think that we just know that if it wasn't because of him, we probably would not have Donald Trump. And that is really on people that are ignorant in the country versus the president, President Obama.
And when you were there, Disha, when you were working and coordinating events, what was your ultimate pinch me moment where you just thought, wow, I can't believe I've arranged this. I can't believe these people are performing here, or I just can't believe I'm here myself. What was it?
I would have to say, I would say Pope Francis. I would say Pope Francis was the moment that I could not believe, because he's, the leader of the Catholic Church. He was a popular pope. We had a popular president. And I just couldn't believe that someone actually trusted me to lead the welcome to the White House for Pope Francis. And it was a moment that was so beautiful, because the weather was beautiful. Everyone was out just in reverence. We had a beautiful Black gospel choir sing. And it was somebody that I think we were all so struck by, not starstruck, but just struck by. And I just couldn't believe that, I was the one in charge of it. And so I think that was a huge pinch me moment for me.
Yeah. Was there any world leader that you were just a bit underwhelmed by, that maybe you've been looking forward to meeting, and frankly, they didn't really deliver?
I wouldn't say there was any world leader
dirt. Come on.
I wouldn't say there was any world leader that was like that. I think that our last year, we had a lot of friendlies. So it was like we had all the Nordic countries, and then we had Canada, we had Singapore. So they were underwhelming, but there was no juice. There was, because, we get along and we're it was kind of having so there was no tense moments to be like, how's this going to go? So I wouldn't say there was none that were underwhelming, but there was some that was just like, oh, this is just like having lunch. Kind of like, yeah. We get along so well. What are we talking about? So I think that we definitely had those moments. But I was just like, what's going to go wrong? Oh, nothing. Okay, well.
I really enjoyed the book, Disha, but I felt so sorry for you when you were young, because you were so hard on yourself. You didn't need anybody else to be hard to you. Are you all right now? And are you satisfied by where you are in life and by what you've achieved?
I am. I mean, first of all, I'm on Times Radio.
Well, doesn't get any better.
That's huge for me. And so I am so much better. I feel better. I've done a lot of therapy and healing and other things, but also I look back on all that I've done and just said, you created this light for yourself. You curated it. But not only that, I make sure that others have the same opportunity or opportunities to at least get out of that hard shell that they have and just go after it. And I feel that way about every day I wake up, I'm still, what else can I do? And I'm so curious. And, you know, when I came over there for my book tour to Europe, I was like, I'm doing four cities for this book. I would have never thought that when I was young. Yeah. And so I think now my curiosity takes place of my any kind of like trauma or anything I went through. And I'm so happy about that.
It's so good to talk to you, Disha, and just get some positivity. Take care of yourself. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
A great pleasure. The book is Undiplomatic and it's by Disha Dyer. And actually, it really does show you, if you see a job advertised, you know what? Sometimes just go for it because you never know. It's 4 minutes to four.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing. With intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6, with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
Listen to Times Radio on your smart speaker. Just say, play Times Radio.
At Kia, we're excited to announce that the refined new Kia Sportage is available in showrooms now. Secure your test drive today to explore its advanced technology and stylish, sporty design. Order before the 30th of September to get 5.9% APR representative and £1,000 PCP finance deposit contribution. Search the new Kia Sportage to book your test drive. T's and C's apply. Kia Finance.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
Running a business can be expensive, which is why at NFU Mutual, we don't charge admin fees with our trades insurance, so you can easily make changes when you need to. No wonder 9 out of 10 of our business insurance customers renew every year. With agency offices across the UK, we're closer to you, closer to your business, closer to what matters. For quality trades insurance to suit all sizes, search NFU Mutual Builders and Trades Insurance.
How are you looking so fresh?
It's my new Samsung Galaxy Watch 8. It's got this thing called Running Coach, which creates custom training plans just for me. Oh, and that's our cue to pick up the pace.
What? This isn't fast enough. Oh.
Smash your fitness goals with a new Galaxy Watch 8. Buy today at Samsung.com. Requires smartphone on Android 11 or above with the latest version of the Samsung Health app.
This is Times Radio.
We know it is all happening at the White House in Washington today, and there will be full coverage here on Times Radio as the evening unfolds. Donald Trump has just posted on Truth Social. Let's give it a go. I've settled 6 wars in 6 months, one of them a possible nuclear disaster, and yet I have to read and listen to many who truly don't have a clue. Tell me everything that I'm doing wrong on the Russia-Ukraine mess. Mess in capitals. That is sleepy Joe Biden's war, not mine. I'm only here to stop it, not to prosecute it any further. It would never, capitals, have happened if I was president. I know exactly what I'm doing, and I don't need the advice of people who've been working on all of these conflicts for years and were never able to do a thing to stop them. They're stupid people, stupid in capitals, with no common sense, intelligence or understanding, and they only make the current disaster more difficult to fix. Fix in capitals. Despite all of my lightweight and very jealous critics, I'll get it done. I always do. President DJT. Not sure my impersonation's all that good. My thanks to Rosie Cutler and Ryan Boyden, technical operator par excellence. John Pienaar is next here on Times Radio. Have a good evening.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Jane. It's 4 o'clock and I'm John Pienaar with Times Radio Drive. Here are the headlines. Sir Keir Starmer's touched down in Washington, D.C. as the Prime Minister and other European leaders gather at the White House to meet Volodymyr Zelensky and Donald Trump. And senior politicians are urging the Prime Minister to recall Parliament over the conflict in Gaza, calling for immediate sanctions on Israel. Coming up, the US President welcoming his Ukrainian counterpart, European leaders at the White House for talks on the future of the war in Ukraine. I'll bring you all of the updates, the analysis and the insights as events in Washington you see unfold over these coming hours. And we're going to be hearing from a former head of NATO policy planning, from a former Foreign Office permanent secretary, and from correspondents in the UK, in the United States, and in Kyiv.
This is Times Radio.
Well, after the news with James Kitchen.
Thank you, John. Good afternoon. Volodymyr Zelensky has reiterated Ukraine is ready to work productively to reach peace after meeting the US Special Envoy Keith Kellogg in Washington. Ahead of talks with Donald Trump, the Ukrainian leader says Russia can only be forced into peace through strength, and President Trump has that strength. Meanwhile, Mr. Trump has taken to Truth Social, posting, "I'm only here to stop the war, not to prosecute it." He adds, "I know what I'm doing." Gideon Rackman is chief foreign affairs commentator of the Financial Times and author of The Age of the Strongman. He told Times Radio President Trump has visions of himself as the ultimate peacemaker.
Tension is almost an end in itself for Trump, but also he does have this vision of himself as a great peacemaker, and he's almost childishly open about his desire to win the Nobel Peace Prize and so on. So I think in his mind, he wants to be the guy who brings Zelensky and Putin together to shake hands and, you know, have a warm embrace and settle it, and then afterwards both say, this could never have happened without Donald Trump. I don't think any of that is going to happen, but I think, yeah, that would be his ultimate vision of how this should end.
Meanwhile, Sir Keir Starmer, who's arrived at the Ukrainian embassy in Washington, says Britain is prepared to put boots on the ground to act as a security guarantee in the event of a deal. Michael O'Hanlon is an American policy analyst from the Brookings Institution. He told Times Radio there's ambiguity as to what such a guarantee would look like.
There are different ways to think about this. Some people have talked about Article 5-like provisions that are not done through NATO. But that requires Senate confirmation in our system, two-thirds vote. And I don't think we're anywhere near forming a treaty that would do that. You could also more pragmatically just have a lot of NATO troops on the ground in Ukraine doing various kinds of training and observation. And that could essentially become a tripwire, a de facto security guarantee.
Elsewhere, almost 2,000 soldiers are fighting fires tearing through land in Spain, roughly the size of metropolitan London. Some roads, paths and rail lines have shut with up to 20 wildfires burning, including in the northwestern region of Galicia. Parts of the famous Camino de Santiago pilgrimage route is closed. Three people have died in the past week. Spain's Prime Minister is Pedro Sanchez.
The main reflection we must have right now is that we have clear answers to problems that are affecting our everyday lives, regardless of the season of the year we are in. Clear answers to why we have fires of this magnitude or strong storms during autumn or winter.
A man's been found guilty for his role in a shooting in East London that left a 9-year-old girl with a bullet lodged in her brain. Javon Riley's been convicted of 3 counts of attempted murder following the incident in Dalston in May last year. A court's heard a shot missed his intended target and hit the girl who was sitting outside a restaurant. Detective Inspector Ben Dalloway from the Met Police says she'll forever be affected.
It was only through the fantastic work of the surgeons at the Great Ormond Street Hospital that she survived. The bullet remains lodged in her brain and forever will be. She has made a good recovery. However, she'll have cognitive and difficulties for the rest of her life.
And almost £200 billion worth of major government projects are at risk of failure and are unachievable in their present form. That's according to official auditors. The financial risk of so-called red-rated projects across Whitehall is now similar to the annual NHS budget. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. John Pienaar at Drive on Times Radio.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. It is good to have your company, which is exactly, I imagine, what Volodymyr Zelensky must be thinking at this moment as he contemplates the plane load of presidents, prime ministers and a NATO secretary general who've landed in Washington to give him a bit of moral support before he faces President Trump at the White House in a couple of hours, hoping to talk about ending the war with Russia, with Ukraine and its freedom left intact, hoping for peace and freedom, fearing the reality is that President Trump is again siding with Vladimir Putin and is keener on a warmer relationship with Russia and all the business deals that go with that than with helping Ukraine resist the Russian invasion. Well, could the US president really value his relationship with Putin more highly than America's historic role as leader of the free world and pillar of the Atlantic Alliance? Well, none of the leaders in Washington to cheer on Zelensky, let alone Zelensky himself, would express that fear out loud. But all of them must be sharing it today, surely. Stay with me. I promise you'll miss none of it. The arrival of Starmer, Macron of France, Merz of Germany, all the European leaders at the White House in under an hour's time. And the crucial meeting between Presidents Trump and Zelensky in the Oval Office an hour later. I promise you, you'll hear all of it in real time. Now, Trump posted a message on his social media account earlier saying Zelensky can end the war immediately if he wants to. Now, of course, any war leader can end a war by capitulating. Who doesn't want peace in Ukraine? But peace at what price? What's the answer from your point of view? What do you think? Send me a text, 87222. Start with the word Times or a tweet to @TimesRadio. Do please join in this conversation. So, Zelensky, he's been meeting with the Ukraine envoy of the United States, Keith Kellogg, writing on X. Zelensky thanked General Kellogg and reiterated Russia attacked Ukraine last night. Two children died as a result. And Keir Starmer, along with the leaders of France, Germany, Finland, Italy, the EU and NATO, are meeting Zelensky before his encounter with Trump. So, the pieces are being put into place ahead of what's coming. First, let's just remind ourselves briefly of that meeting back in February. Remember that and how that panned out?
If you will speak very loudly about the war, you
He's not speaking loudly. Your country is in big trouble.
Can I answer?
Wait a minute. No. You've done a lot of talking. Your country is in big trouble.
I know.
You're not winning. You're not winning this. You have a damn good chance of coming out okay because of us.
Mr. President, we are staying in our country, staying strong from the very beginning of the war. We've been alone.
He wants to make a deal. I don't know if you can make a deal. The problem is I've empowered you to be a tough guy. And I don't think you'd be a tough guy without the United States. And your people are very brave. But you're either going to make a deal or we're out. And if we're out, you'll fight it out. I don't think it's going to be pretty.
Why don't you wear a suit? Why don't you wear a suit? You're the highest level in this country's office, and you refuse to wear a suit. Just want to see if you do own a suit?
From the very beginning of the war,
you're not in a good position.
I don't have the
cards right now. With us, you start having
I'm not
cards.
Playing cards.
Right now, you don't
have
you're playing cards.
Mr. President.
You're playing
I'm very
cards.
Serious.
You're gambling
I'm
with the lives of
war.
Millions of people.
You think,
you're gambling with World War III. You're gambling
about?
With
what
World War III. And what you're doing is very disrespectful to the country, this country, that's backed
you
far more than a lot of people said they should have.
Have you said thank you once?